10:07.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And here's the president's problem. An isolated and power-hungry dictator with the potential to use weapons of mass destruction is considered a threat to neighboring and distant states. Everyone knows that this nation and this dictator have threatened the peace in the past. Saddam Hussein? No, it's Kim Jong-il. That's why the president of the United States put North Korea squarely on a list of enemies that he calls the Axis of Evil. That's why President Bush made this promise 1 year ago.
I will not wait on events while dangers gather. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons.
But since that time, it's been all Iraq. Thousands of troops and shiploads of hardware are now in the Gulf. The UN has successfully reinstalled weapons inspectors. But at the same time, North Korea is skillfully using this dust storm of activity in the Gulf to restart its own nuclear program, firing up its reactors, promising to build weapons, and just this past week, kicking out weapons inspectors. So our question this hour, how do we make sense of the Bush administration's split-screen policy on Iraq and North Korea? Is the United States aiming its military muscle at the right target? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today, two men who know these issues well. James Lilly was U.S. ambassador to China and South Korea under Presidents Reagan and Bush. He's currently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Leon Firth was, or rather is, a professor of international affairs at George Washington University's Elliott School. He was national security advisor to Vice President Al Gore for 7 years. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ambassador Lilly, let me start with you. The recent events, developments in North Korea, do you think that they are reason enough for the Bush administration to reconsider, to ask if it's aiming at the right target?
No, I don't think so. I think Iraq is a much more acute problem than North Korea. I think North Korea we can handle. I don't think we can snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. We are working up a coalition of forces of the nations around North Korea. They have a common goal, as stated already, to get rid of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. And now we've got an awful lot of work to do to bring them together to the extent that they can begin to influence North Koreans' policy on weapons of mass destruction. It'll take time.
Okay, let me be specific. You're saying diplomatic moves in for North Korea, military moves for Iraq.
No, diplomatic moves include economic leverage, include political give and take. It involves, let's say, honeypots at the end, the Japanese reparations package, all international financial institutions. If Korea goes in the right direction, North Korea, there is this advantageous future for it. If it goes in the other direction, it's deprived of these things.
Leon Firth, what do you think about the strategy of the Bush administration now focusing, as it is, on Iraq with what we're hearing from North Korea?
I think the strategy is incoherent. And although consistency is not required when thinking of tactics in difficult situations, effectiveness is, it's very hard to make sense of what they are talking about. North Korea is imminently a nuclear threat and on its way to becoming even more so. The timetable for that is soon rather than distant, as is the case with Iraq. I don't know what coalition of forces we're talking about, but I remember some lessons from our days in the Clinton administration, and one of them is that when you're negotiating about vital interests, you do not supplicate unless you are prepared to back it up with force. And you never take an option off the table like military force in a situation like this. The president has already done that.
But isn't it universally accepted that a military attack on North Korea would be a suicidal attack for South Koreans, for the American forces who are helping the South Koreans, and in fact, for the entire peninsula?
Whatever uncertainties the North Korean government must face in dealing with us have now been diminished by the president's assurance that we will not use violence. I remember when President Clinton made an error by stating early in the conflict with Serbia over Kosovo that we would not use ground forces, and I remember how severely the Republican side criticized him for taking that option off the table, even if there were no plans to employ it anytime soon. It was a bad move.
So just to clarify here, you're saying that the military attention that is currently focused on Iraq needs to be split, divided, more attention on North Korea, less on Iraq?
I don't think we're in a very good position to split military attention, even if we do have some possibility for doing so. It's just not a good idea. What I'm saying is that you never take a card off the table for nothing. And the president has taken the card of military force off the table for nothing.
Ambassador Lilly, let me hear you on that.
Well, I think if we're getting partisan now, I think the 1993-94 moves by the Clinton administration to threaten a preemptive attack on Yongbyon were not welcomed in South Korea. They were just horrified that the Americans would take this kind of unilateral action. Right now, playing with force, with South Korea being dead set against it, Japan being against it, China being against it, Russia being against it, doesn't make sense. The military option is there in the sense that if North Korea ever takes provocative military action, they will be wiped out. And they know that the force option is off the table for them because they've used it very effectively on the Clinton administration to extort great amounts of grain, food, etc. This time, that game is over. You do not get this sort of unconditional food aid from the United States any longer. What aid you get will be project aid, will be carefully monitored, transparent. It'll be reciprocity will be built into it. So I say that in this case, we've got a coalition. If Leon doesn't know what the coalition is, let's walk through some of the countries around North Korea. I'd start with Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, the four main ones.
But Russia, China, and Japan and South Korea are all in favor of engaging with North Korea. What we're hearing from Washington right now is a policy of increasing isolation.
I don't think so. They're having a meeting of the South Koreans, Japanese, and Americans this week. We're not going to throttle the South Korean program. We never have. They went ahead. Bush blessed the sunshine policy of Kim Dae-jung in March 2001. We can see that South Korea's plan to draw North Korea in by investment, trade, the various tools at its hands can begin to change that regime economically and eventually politically. What our role to do is to say you will not use nuclear weapons, and we're going to work with China and other countries to get North Korea to move in the direction of backing off from its nuclear weapons program.
Okay,
I think that's exactly the right project.
But Leon Firth, are you saying that the North Koreans now no longer have to pay any attention to the United States whenever it speaks on this because the military option is not imminent?
They have less to worry about because of the president's assurances that we're not contemplating any such move. As for coalitions or whatever Ambassador Lilly wants to call it, what we're really talking about here is a program of economic sanctions. I'm very aware of the strengths and limitations of economic sanctions. We use them against Serbia. They can help, but it is a very slow process. And in the meantime, the North Koreans have put themselves on a very fast track.
So you're saying that the United States cannot or should not use sanctions at this point?
We should use whatever is at our disposal, but I think that a lot of what we're getting out of the administration is not really an assessment of where we stand, but spin to take the edge off the very real crisis that we're facing.
See, I have a little bit of trouble not ever having been inside an administration, as you two both have, to know whether or not two completely separate programs like this can be prosecuted at the same time. Let's assume, for the sake of the argument, that consistency is not the issue, that you don't necessarily have to be seen to be doing exactly the same thing in one part of the world that you're doing in the other. But can a country like the United States, with its current condition, its current strength, successfully manage in an engaged way something that looks as threatening as North Korea at the same time as it's trying to deal with Iraq?
I think we have the means as a government to manage two crises simultaneously.
Well, I agree with Leon that we do. I don't think that's a problem. Rumsfeld dealt with the military aspects the other day, but there's also other aspects, the concentration you place. Let's look at North Korea, how dependent upon they are on the foreign support. Look at China. The Wall Street Journal has the statistics today as they've dredged them out. 70% of the crude oil that goes to North Korea is from China. Almost $580 million worth of food last year, 200,000 tons of cereals, 40,000 tons of soybeans. Add this on to the perhaps the $600 to $700 million that the U.S. has poured into North Korea. If that is slowed down, I'm not asking for sanctions. Mm-hmm. The Chinese don't operate that way. They just slow down. They take the grain and they say, you're going to pay world prices for it because we have a grain shortage. We love you, North Korea, but we simply cannot supply the grain free. You'll pay for it. Or, let's say, friendly prices. There's all sorts of ratcheting up and down you can do with North Korea. And I think we've got this hold on them because they are sucking on our pipeline to survive.
Okay.
And if you begin to close that pipeline, they are going to suffer a great deal.
But here's the part that I don't get, that the President Bush is saying that Saddam Hussein's day of reckoning has come. Why doesn't the same language apply in North Korea, whereas, as Leon Firth points out, they may be even closer to a nuclear weapon?
It just wouldn't work. You couldn't make it work in North Korea because South Korea will never buy it. They are the key actor in this thing. You can't begin to fling your force option around with South Korea. They almost went berserk in 93, 94 when Clinton did it. They were in my office every day. Oh, you Americans can use your force from 10,000 miles away, but we'll get 100,000 shells on Seoul. They don't want this option. And they are South Korea. It's their peninsula. We are a supporting role in this thing.
I think it's very important to make sure that the values of words are kept in order. If you don't like the word sanction because you say nobody's going to pass a new Security Council resolution, or maybe we'll go to the council and ask for them, what we are trying to do is to throttle what's left of their economy. A sanction is a sanction is a sanction. And you also seem to be talking about making them go hungry, which means we attack the people for the sins of the government, which is something I thought I just read that the administration wasn't going to do. And the administration says it's not going to negotiate with them, but you're saying that we should somehow tacitly suggest that at the end of this rainbow there will be a pot of goodies. That's a negotiation by whatever title you want to put on it. And while it may be the thing that we should be investigating in this particular circumstance that we find ourselves, it would be nice to use the right words and not spin them to mean something else. The administration is looking to negotiate.
Well, I think sanctions is a word that people have written books about and said it doesn't work, except possibly in South Africa. You have to have all countries involved, and it can have an effect, even in the Balkans. But the important thing is that the United States has to start to set the agenda, and we're doing this now. We're giving the North Koreans preconditions for dealing with them on what they call their essential factor is non-aggression treaty with us, which means pull out of all American troops out of South Korea. The South Koreans are not ready for that. The North Koreans are fishing in troubled waters with the South. It isn't working as well as they'd hoped yet, because their proposal at New Year's that they should get together and work against the U.S. was rejected solidly by the South.
Let me just stop you right there. We're at 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And our question for you, is the U.S. aiming its military muscle at the right target at this moment, looking at the news that we're seeing coming out of North Korea and coming out of Iraq? You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about North Korea and Iraq and American involvement with those two countries, both on the axis of evil. With me on the program today, James Lilly, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, was U.S. ambassador to South Korea under President Reagan and U.S. ambassador to China under the first President Bush. Leon Firth is also with us. He's a professor of international affairs at George Washington University, was national security advisor to Vice President Al Gore for 7 years. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Burlington, Massachusetts, and Hatter's on the line. Hi, Hatter.
Hi, Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I'm on my cell phone, so hope you can hear my question okay.
I'll just ask you to be brief.
I just have some observation about our approach towards these two different countries, and just would like to hear comments from your guest about the observation. So the observation is that I think so far the Bush administration hasn't done a very good job of explaining to the world our strategy and how it's different, that why with North Korea we could take a diplomatic approach as opposed to with Iraq. And if we don't do a very good explanation of this strategy, it could be that we will make more enemies and create more anxiety, especially in the Middle East, because some people might be thinking that we are picking an easier target where our casualties might be less in Iraq, and we are avoiding North Korea.
Right. There may, in fact, be some evidence to that as we're listening to other stories in the news today, a national day of strikes in Pakistan, with people there raising that specific point. Leon Firth, let me ask you, in response to Hatter's point, whether or not it's a bad job of explaining policy that the Bush administration's guilty of.
I think they, under the best of conditions, are going to have trouble explaining what they're doing, because what they're really doing is trying to put this problem with North Korea on a slow track until they can deal with Iraq. And they are hoping for a lucky break, because nobody can preclude the possibility that North Korea will continue to march straight towards serial production of nuclear weapons, in which case nothing the administration is talking about tells us what it intends to do.
Slow track, in your mind, is hoping that the United Nations will pick this up?
Throwing it into the United Nations, which the Bush administration has never admired very much in the past. Talking about what by any other name is economic sanctions, which Republicans in general have thought don't work too decisively. And basically, I think, hoping that the North Korean government will be sufficiently impressed by all of this, and possibly by some promises of inducements at the end, to reverse course. And, of course, given some of the things the administration has had to say about verification, one wonders how they would be sure about this. I don't envy anybody this predicament. It is not a partisan matter. It's a terrible fix for the United States to be in.
Jim Lilly, I want to hear you on the idea that the U.S. is hoping to slow-track North Korea by shifting it to the U.N., but first to Hatter's point about whether or not the United States is in danger here of being seen to target specifically the Arabs in Iraq while shifting focus away from Asia.
Well, I think that in terms of explaining our policy in North Korea, the administration has done this. They haven't given one speech, but you can read in all the messages they're saying certain things I think are quite clear, that this is a problem of a major economic problem, that the force option is not on the table at this point, although it could be, and that we sense that North Korea is in effect contained at this moment. They have not launched a major invasion since 1950, when they got a terrible beating. Saddam, of course, has launched two invasions. He also lost both of those, too. But it's a question of how you judge the policies of the country you're working on. And we judge that the North Koreans can be held in check by the combination of forces that we have, not by economic sanctions. The Chinese know how to do this without some sanction. They just cut back on aid that they give them. We will provide them some food, but much less than we provided before. But again and again, through other channels, through the Chinese, through the South Koreans, through the U.N., we're in touch with these North Koreans all the time. They're getting the messages.
Are you just describing a different version of the slow tracking that Leon's talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about of managing this in a way that we can get cohesion among our friends and allies to deal with a very nasty problem, a failed state, a broken state, that has a weird political system, is very hard to deal with. We aren't going to plunge into anything with these guys, because they can take precipitous action, and we don't want them to do that. Our South Korean allies insist on it. As we build this group of forces, this coordination, then we take coordinated action, carefully, slowly, in many ways covertly, to turn the screws on North Korea over a long period of time. I think this is the way you're going to eventually get results.
Okay, Hatter, thanks for your call to Somerville, Massachusetts now, and Joe is joining us. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, really. One is, how come we as a country get surprised that as we go around threatening everybody with our military might, plus we have our record of destruction and for the last 55 years, for good or bad, we are the leading country in raising other people's cities and killing their citizens. We have this huge military might, and we threaten the whole planet. How do you expect other countries to just say, oh, please let me just do whatever you say? It doesn't happen that way.
You're saying that the North Korean reaction to build up its nuclear arsenal is a natural reaction to the way the U.S. behaves?
Absolutely. The same as Israel had the right to have nuclear weapons to, you know, because it has real enemies around them.
Or Pakistan in terms of India in terms of Pakistan.
Absolutely. I don't see any other different reason. I mean, you know, if I had a neighbor who was threatening me...
Okay, but Joe, let's get to the point here. I mean, if it's fine to say, yes, it's clear to see why these people might want nuclear weapons, but based on everything that anyone knows about the Stalinist dictatorship of North Korea, it seems like pretty dangerous business for the whole world to have Kim Jong-il with his finger on the button, doesn't it?
I agree, but I want to say something. We always knew that if Hitler had got nuclear weapons, you'll have used it. We think that this guy will use it. Well, I mean, there's something. We are very nice guys. We did use it, and we used... Yes, I still don't understand why we use it. We said it was to defend our troops. I guess it's a lame argument. Everybody, any general in the world can say, I'm going to use nuclear weapons to defend my troops, and you'll be entitled to that opinion, too. Plus, we are the only country that have the record of using nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. And we have used it. We're proud of it. We threaten people with it. We have our aircraft carriers all over the world. I mean, listen, I don't think it's easy to be another little country out there.
All right, Joe, let me hear from Leon Firth on whether or not the U.S. is in some way, large or small, part responsible for encouraging the nuclear development in places like North Korea.
No, I don't think so at all. First of all, about the historical record, so far as I know, the United States never used biological weapons, never used chemical weapons, used nuclear weapons twice, and then went through the entire Cold War, building up every possible inhibition against a repetition of their use, and devoted major resources to trying to prevent proliferation. And I just don't accept the view that places this country on a moral plane of equivalency with countries like North Korea, which, among other things, have been allowing large numbers of their population to die of malnutrition while they paid for these programs. We are not on the same level. And whatever motivations the North Koreans have, if they are afraid of us, that's their problem. Why have they made a decision to develop in secret a uranium enrichment capability which violated the bargain they struck to stop their plutonium production? What is their objective other than the pursuit of power and prestige at any cost?
Or, Ambassador Lilly, the view from the top in that country that they're perhaps better placed to negotiate from a position of strength, even if that strength means having active nuclear weapons.
I'd first agree with what Leon just said. I think this idea of our using two nuclear weapons against Japan in 1945 was an act of murderous, whatever you want to call it. It was not. It saved hundreds and thousands of lives. But let me just tell you about North Korea a little bit, what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a country that's has been building its nuclear program probably since 1980. It's been in there for about 22 years. The missiles were started about the same time. They have a track record of a sabotage, blowing up K-858 with 115 Koreans on board, of killing half the South Korean cabinet in Rangoon, of sending assassination teams down. They have a track record of violence. But it's cunning violence. It's not massive violence, because they learned that lesson in 1950. But you're dealing with a country that has huge gulags. They just discovered a new one in Northeast Korea, which has perhaps 50 to 100,000 people. And there's probably 8 to 10 of these in the country. And the horror stories that come out through the refugees in China will turn your hair white, what the way people are treated. So you're dealing with a very, very nasty country. Therefore, you are proceeding quite carefully, quite logically, hitting them at their weak point. Don't go after their strong point. Their weak point is their economy. And you work on that because you know there are North Koreans who are thoroughly fed up with their status system. They know it doesn't work. They know change has to come. It's probably pre-1978 for China when you're dealing with the people of the Gang of Four, the Cultural Revolution crazies, in charge. China got rid of them, and the pragmatists took over. This is what we're looking for in North Korea, hopefully. It's not likely to happen soon, but there must be forces in there that are going to rise up and begin to change the internal structure. And that, again, will lead, I believe, to a change in their nuclear policy, especially if that is rewarded by goods from all of the surrounding countries, including us.
Let's move on to another call. Joe, thanks for that. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And with us on the program in our conversation about North Korea and Iraq, two men whose involvement with this country's foreign policy stretches back 25 years under different administrations. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky now. Rakia's on the line. Hi, Rakia.
Hi. It's interesting. Here is North Korea is more a threat to the United States than it is Saddam Hussein, but then the Bush administration is willing to negotiate with North Korea, but not Saddam Hussein. It seems like it's pretty interesting. The way it looks like, he doesn't mind, you know, going and killing Muslim children and Muslim countries because they are easy target. They got natural resources. The same thing when Mullah Omar said, we will hand Osama bin Laden to the international court, and the Bush administration refused, and he went and bombed and killed 3,000-4,000 innocent people because they were easy target, and they wanted their pipeline. And to us, we feel like, you know, the Bush administration does not mind killing Muslims around the world because they are easy target, natural resources.
Rakia,
it is very unfair.
Let's be specific here, because the Bush administration is not in negotiations with North Korea. Neither is the Bush administration's in negotiations with Iraq. But are you asking why they're not even trying to pursue some kind of diplomatic moves with Iraq?
Absolutely.
Okay,
let's
put that to
ambassador. If they can do it with North Korea, why not with Iraq?
Right. Okay, we'll put that to Jim Lilly.
I think we're doing it a different way with Iraq. We're working through the UN Security Council. We're working through UN inspectors.
There's a very big pistol aimed at Saddam Hussein's head right now. I mean, the military option that Rakia is talking about is a very big part of the U.S. policy.
And yes, that's what I was going to say. It's backed up with military power. Ergo, you've gotten more done in the last month than you had in the last number of years. Saddam is moving. I don't say we're going to get at his nuclear
stockpiles. What do you mean he's moving?
He's allowed the inspectors back in, A. He's allowed them much greater access than they had before. He's turned in his inventory. I'm not saying these are moves that are going to clear up the situation. I'm saying he is moving in a direction because he fears what we're doing. And he's letting these people come in, and he's letting them get into his palaces, into underground areas. He's getting the helicopters flying over certain places, we suspect, and letting people get in there fast. They've talked about giving access to some of the scientists and even possibly getting them out of the country. I'm not saying it's complete, but I'm saying it's working to a degree. But the use of force is a very powerful element in this to get him to agree, and it has been working.
Leon.
Well, it's an interesting assessment of what's going on in Iraq. Nothing the administration has been saying suggests that they think that Saddam Hussein is moving. On the contrary, they keep on issuing daily bulletins to the effect that he is not. So maybe something is going on here that they're not sharing with the public. And there's also an interesting historical note. The father of President Bush undertook a policy of trying to reach an accommodation with Saddam Hussein. It's just a big article in the Washington Post about the nature of these agreements a few days ago. So, in effect, they tried the make nice approach with Saddam Hussein, and it turned out to be a disaster. And, of course, all subsequent efforts to negotiate with him have proved to be disasters, and that's what President Bush has been pointing out over and over again. I agree that the threat of military force makes our diplomacy look convincing. But that, of course, raises the question why the threat of military force is notably absent, completely, in the case of Korea.
Can I ask you both what may be a very silly question, and that is that we hear so much on the radio and read in the papers every day bulletins about the number of troops that are being moved, the hospital ships that are going here, all the details about the preparations for war in Iraq. If there were military preparations for some kind of attack on North Korea, would we be hearing anything about that at all, or would that have to be much more quiet and underground? It could be could it be that we're just talking about what the administration would have us talk about? Ambassador Lilly.
The movement of troops can't be done secretly now, as you know. The volume is too large. The ships can be spotted. There are satellites that are not ours out there watching these movements, so that we know that they know what we're doing, so we might as well say it. But also, I think it's a psychological pressure on Saddam. And he has been doing, let's say, somewhat more than he has before, because we have been using this military card, backed up by a UN resolution, which was unanimously approved. And we're taking him to the edge. Again, when you get to North Korea, the military threat of preemptive strike at this point would be counterproductive because of the attitude of South Korea
and China. Okay, but Mr. Firth, if the threat was there, would we know about it?
I agree with Ambassador Lilly. It's very hard in today's circumstances, even with an administration that is better than most at keeping its secrets, to do something like bolstering forces, either in South Korea or even moving them towards South Korea without having it noticed.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, North Korea and Iraq, American policy with these two countries, both put by President Bush on his axis of evil, but both at this point being subjected to or engaged in very different aspects of foreign policy. Your thoughts on that, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, Leon Firth. He's a professor of international affairs at George Washington University, was national security advisor to Vice President Al Gore for 7 years, and had better than a decade in the Foreign Service prior to that. James Lilly is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, was U.S. ambassador to South Korea under President Reagan, assistant secretary of defense for international affairs in the Bush administration from 91 to 93, and also U.S. ambassador to China under first President Bush from 89 to 1991. We're taking a look at the current policy of the administration vis-a-vis Iraq and North Korea and trying to make sense of how it is that one policy works in one place or one policy is made to work or thought to work in another place. We're going to Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Jay's joining us. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Well, I kind of get a little upset when I listen to these things, because I keep hearing that, you know, there needs to be a nuclear buildup on this side as, you know, to keep a threat from coming. But the larger issue is our foreign policy. I mean, until we deal with the way that we deal with other countries, none of this is going to change. We can put up, we can have vaccinations, we can have missile defense sites and everything like that. But the truth of the matter is the U.S., the Bush administration especially, runs roughshod over the rest of the world. And that's the real situation there. They want the world to be peaceful as long as they can maintain in being in charge. That's the way I see it.
So are you saying that the administration needs to alter its policy with both Iraq and North Korea in this case?
The entire world, as we're beginning to see because of this, the situations that are going on, the rest of the world views us as more of a threat than anybody else that we're mentioning as a threat. That's the major thing we need to look at, but we don't. Why?
Okay, Leon Firth, the whole idea of empire as alienating allies and enemies alike.
Yeah, well, I hear the next generation making noise in the background of the...
throwing pots and pans around.
Yes, it must be the caller's kitchen. But the question is, are we doing anything in investing some of our wealth and power for the sake of the next generation? And I don't think that we're doing nearly enough. Our focus, especially in recent years, seems to have been on making things safe for ourselves, but not on defining a future condition of the world where other people can participate. And I think that's what the caller may be talking about.
Jim Lilly, too much bully, not enough peacemaker?
Oh, I don't think so. I think in both the Iraq and Korean situations, we've used the United Nations Security Council very heavily, and they've been part of the act as NATO was in the Balkans. We've been working with the coalitions of other countries. But let me just say one thing about this. In Asia, for instance, the situation is changing in very basic ways. The Soviet Union presence in Siberia is almost gone. It's a very weak, backward area. It doesn't have these SS-18 missiles. Our relationship with China is beginning to move ahead. Our relationship with Japan seems to be stable. We've got to work out something with South Korea, and I think we will, because they're sounding more and more compatible, I think, these days.
And you're leaving out of the equation the change in relations between South Korea and China as the economies of the two draw those two much closer together than they've been in the past.
Absolutely. I was going to get to that, but you anticipated me. This is one of the major changes since 10 years ago when China had about $500 million of trade with South Korea. This is a booming effort. Culturally, they've had the first exchange of ships, naval ships. They have moved ahead in all different areas in trade and investment. South Korea is probably going to put $1 billion into China investment next year. There's a China fever.
Okay, but the scary part about this is that North Korea is running out of allies. If the communist ties that used to link China and North Korea are weakened, if the Soviet Union's disappearance from Siberia is no longer an issue there, then the North Koreans might feel themselves even more isolated, even more inclined to use nuclear weapons and damn the neighbors.
I don't think so. I think you underestimate the Chinese. The Chinese have taken Kim Jong-il down to Shanghai. They've taken him to Shenzhen. They've shown him around China. And they've shown what could be done with opening up their economy while keeping political control, as they have. He's seen this. He's approved of it. He's gone back. He's tried it once and was showed incredible incompetence by setting up this free zone in Sinuiju next to the Chinese border and getting a big fat Chinese crook to come over and run it, who's now in jail in China. I mean, their fumbling attempts, North Korea, are there, but the Chinese will sustain North Korea in their own way, but they will use their leverage that they have up and down. They've done this before very effectively to get the North Koreans to move in a certain direction. And I think you're going to see some more and more of this happening, that we can coordinate with the Chinese can coordinate with us. And, of course, the one thing that the Chinese fear more than perhaps anything else is a nuclear Japan, a nuclear Taiwan, a nuclear South Korea. If this North Korean nuclear thing can stand and the Chinese implicitly support it, they're going to face terrible problems around their periphery in other countries that might go nuclear because of what the North Koreans have done. So this is something we've got to work diplomatically and politically and economically. And I think we're on this track right now.
Leon Firth, do you want to add something to this?
Yeah, I think it's a track with a deep rut in it. Maybe the Chinese will pitch in and really lean on the North Koreans, and maybe not. It remains to be seen. And in the past, when we and the previous administration asked for this, and our relations with China were fairly good at the time, they would say, who knows what those crazy people up in North Korea think, and you overestimate our level of influence with them. And then maybe they did something quietly, but it was not revolutionary. And if they did intervene, then how does that explain what North Korea is doing now, which really is walking the fine edge of a confrontation with the United States? One point that Ambassador Lilly raised that I would recommend to you is this. Something big is happening in Asia. First of all, the balance of power is being disturbed by the appearance of China as a great power and by Japanese economic stagnation. And secondly, it doesn't take much imagination to see North Korea emerge as a major regional nuclear power while all of this slow negotiation with them is taking place. And I don't know whether we've thought through what the implications of that are going to be.
Let's go back to our callers, 1-800-423-8255, to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Nick's joining us. Hi, Nick.
Hi. The question I have to ask is how much the nuclear development of the development of nuclear weapons by the North Koreans might play into the internal politics of Korea. Traditional wisdom has been that South Korea doesn't want to get a hold of North Korea or pursue unification too quickly because it would be really expensive. But it might be the only way they could become a nuclear power if they reunified with a nuclear North Korea. And in this might explain why North Korea is developing the weapons, because it's making itself a more interesting product for a South Korean buyout, so to speak.
So what are you saying is South Korea's specific strategy here, that they want to pretend they don't want nuclear weapons on the northern border, but in fact it's not such a bad idea?
Well, they might, in a context in which they become more strongly involved with North Korea and move more strongly towards unification, it may be the only way they could become a nuclear power, and they may be interested in being a nuclear power. You know, not so much North Korea as a nuclear power, but Korea as a nuclear power. I mean, I'm sure they've signed the non-proliferation treaties, and they can't develop nuclear weapons for themselves. North Koreans develop nuclear weapons and then reunify with a...
Okay, let me try this on Jim Lilly, because, Jim, you watched the recent election of... that took place in South Korea with Noh Moo-hyun being elected in part on an anti-American, with anti-American support. Is it even conceivable what Nick's talking about?
Oh, I think it is conceivable. They use the same argument on China-Taiwan, that China isn't as tough as it could be on Taiwan for economic reasons, obviously, but also because they could inherit the American arms that we sell to Taiwan when they unify. I don't think this is a factor there. I think it's always in the back of Koreans' minds that they wouldn't mind having nuclear weapons, but I think that is a very secondary issue. I think the main thrust in the South is they've gone through this election. The Americans have made some mistakes in our military posture in South Korea, and this has lasted a long time. It was in my tour. It was before me. We've got to correct this. We've got to correct the military structure there to make it more compatible with South Korean nationalism. But the South Koreans see that they can get North Korea by what they call aggressive economic tactics. And this is linking up the power grids, pulling the North Korean economy into the Incheon airport, setting up a Kaesong industrial zone in which they're the major investors, getting the railroads linked up along the along the east and west coast. And they see that this pulls them together, and that North Korea will then be drawn in by South Korea, aid, investment, trade, and China will then be brought into this triangle too, because of the heavy trade between and investment between South Korea and China. And China, in turn, goes in and supports this new policy of economic reform in North Korea. This is what I think will happen. The Koreans, of course, always call themselves a shrimp among eight whales. I don't think they're going to become a formidable nuclear power in Asia. I don't think anybody's going to let this happen. And I do think, Leon, that the Chinese know one heck of a lot more about what's happening in North Korea than they say they do, because if they say they don't know it, they can bow out of a situation.
Yeah, I also thought they protested a little too much about the state of their ignorance, but that was their response.
I know, I've heard that same thing.
Can we go back to...
Before you do that, one point that I think needs to be made connected to this last discussion.
Yeah.
The linkage between proliferation in the Korean Peninsula, even if North Korea disappears, is Japan. If there is a nuclear-armed Korea, there is likely to be a nuclear-armed Japan and vice versa. That's the linkage between the two because of the historical relations between these two peoples. And so one of the things that makes this development in North Korea so threatening is the possibility that if it continues on, it could have the kind of impact I just forecast.
Leon, you started the program by saying that the U.S. policy in dealing with North Korea and Iraq and trying to sort of square the two of them was incoherent. What would you see being done differently?
It's tough because it would be so easy to be glib. I do think the president should not have taken an option off the table, even if he had no intention of using it.
The military option in North Korea.
Yeah, not as cleanly and quickly as it came off the table. I really believe that what we better start thinking about in general are very dynamic changes in our security situation in East Asia. And what we're going to do about a North Korea that will probably, that we ought to count on acquiring uncomfortably high numbers of nuclear weapons. I think the contrary assumption that they will stop what they're doing at this point is the optimist's assumption, and it's a little difficult to justify it.
Jim Lilly, is it your expectation or your fear that, in fact, North Korea will end up with nuclear weapons?
Yes, I think they will. They consider the nuclear weapons essential to their survival. This is a very broken down, poor country, and the Koreans do have a paranoia about their neighbors in any strong country. And North Korea believes that this is their security, their eventual security. I suppose if one can be a little flippant, you could say that if they buried these nuclear weapons 10,000 feet underground and took their missiles and got rid of them, this, again, would be perhaps ensure their security. But I would say a better option is that we, the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese, and hopefully the Russians and EU, work towards the elimination of this state, because I think as long as they have the kind of government they have, it's going to be a problem for all of us.
Military elimination or diplomatic
elimination? No, have them collapse. I think this country is perhaps has some similarities, a few similarities to Eastern Europe, that when they begin to lose their great brothers and the Koreans have been dependent upon China for support for an awful long time going back to the Ming Dynasty. And when this is taken away from them, they feel very insecure. But China has a key role to assure these people, perhaps even offering them a nuclear umbrella if they'll stop their own production.
Ambassador Lilly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
James Lilly was U.S. Ambassador to China and South Korea under Reagan and Bush, currently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Leon Firth, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Mr. Firth, professor of international affairs at George Washington University's Elliott School, was national security advisor to Vice President Al Gore. For 7 years, Connection listeners, we invite you to our online forum. We're at theconnection.org. If you've thoughts and ideas you'd like to share with other people, you'll find there. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WB.